Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because we have with us this evening a very, very special guest. His name is Mr. C. William Michaels, and we're going to be talking about his book, No Greater Threat, which is really an analysis of the USA Patriot Act. Now, Mr. Michaels is a lawyer, so he can understand this document. It's got 150 sections, about 200 pages. It's a very complex law. And yet, of course, just 46 days after the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center on September 11th of last year, the USA Patriot Act was enacted. It had gone through both houses, both the Senate and the House. It had been signed by the president. It was the law of the land. Well, now, the disturbing thing about this is it was, of course, passed under the hysteria, under the fear of the anthrax attack, a very strange anthrax attack, indeed, because it would appear that the anthrax came from our own military laboratories, and certainly some people knew it was coming because Vice President Cheney and members of the White House staff were started on antibiotics on Cipro the very evening of the September 11th attack. Who there was thinking about an anthrax attack? But because of the anthrax attack, and because the members of Congress were told, oh, we have to do something to fight the wicked terrorists, they weren't even allowed to read the bill before they voted on it. And it really contained all the various draconian police state measures that Bill Clinton couldn't get enacted in 1995 when he tried to get them through Congress after the bombing of the Murrah Building. But, of course, George Bush got that through September and October of last year. Well, now, what does this bill really entail? To me, it's one of the most frightening pieces of legislation I've ever read. It's almost as frightening as the Office of Homeland Security, because none of these things, in my estimation, are really aimed at Islamic terrorism. They're aimed at changing the relationship between the individual and government. And with that as an opening, Mr. Michaels, thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting pretty late back where you live.
Yes, I'm here in the East Coast, and so it's 11 p.m. my time, but that's okay. I'm a night owl anyway. This is no problem for me. Good evening, and I hope your listeners are paying attention because we have some very important things to discuss.
Well, let's first of all, USA Patriot. Now, that everybody thinks that this has to do with patriotism. What does USA Patriot stand for?
It stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism.
All right, fine.
That's what it stands for.
But then, of course, in this bill, we sort of redefine terrorism. In other words, does it have to be Islamic terrorism we're talking about?
Oh, no, not at all, even though that may have been the impetus for the Patriot Act itself. But terrorism is defined in a couple of ways throughout the Act. But there is no specific restriction in the definition to Islamic terrorism or terrorism coming from any particular corner of the globe.
You know, aren't they talking about the domestic terrorism, too? And, of course, could you define what is terrorism today? Have we changed the definition of that? And really, I think this is really the crux of the whole situation. The American people were told this was Islamic terrorism. We wanted to prevent Osama bin Laden from, of course, attacking us. But what is terrorism now? How have we changed the definition of it?
Well, I don't think the definition has so much changed as the understanding of it has been expanded. I think terrorism has always been widely understood as an attempt by a group or individuals, usually a small group of individuals, to create a change in a particular policy or action, usually of a country, by acts of violence or threatening acts of violence.
But isn't it simply by coercion? Hasn't that changed?
Right.
That by, if we're trying by acts of coercion to change government, that would be considered terrorism.
Right. And as I mentioned, I think that what's happening, especially with the Patriot Act, is we've expanded that basic kind of common understanding of what a terrorist act is to include coercion, to include attempts, to include conspiracy, to include material support, to include membership in a terrorist organization, and any number of things that used to be sort of on the fringes or the boundaries of terrorism, and bring it much more to center stage and within the new powers and authorities, investigative and surveillance authorities that are given to the federal government by the Patriot Act.
But there certainly is no mention of Islamic terrorism as such in the bill.
No specific mention.
All right, fine. So then I think, of course, the next thing is, what does it do to the police powers of the state, and what does it do to the relationship between the federal and state and local police? But let's talk about, first of all, the police powers of the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Patriot Act, especially in Titles 2 and 9, and to a certain extent Title 4, greatly expands the surveillance and the investigative and search authorities of the federal government.
All right.
You have a nationwide service of search warrants. You have increased activity for intelligence and surveillance involving foreign intelligence, and that's very broadly defined. You have single jurisdiction warrants. You have delayed notification of sneak and peek warrants. Expanded telecommunications and electronic surveillance authorities, and new information that could be attained by federal officials even without a court order. And those include consumer records, financial records, educational records, and information from an internet service provider.
All right, now let's just take a few of those things, because, you know, we say, well, after all, we got to do something about these wicked terrorists. What is a sneak and peek attack, and why should we be concerned about that, or giving to the federal government the ability to have the ability to go into homes without the knowledge or consent of the person involved? What is this sneak and peek concept?
A sneak and peek warrant used to be confined to certain very restricted investigations under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and certain other specified long-range investigations, where under a sneak and peek warrant that's issued by a court, federal investigators can come into somebody's home or business premises, usually without the person present, and in fact, generally it's designed to be without the person present, and not necessarily seize or remove anything. It's called a non-physical search warrant, but you can copy documents, you can maybe take notes on what's available through a review of the premises or searching through rooms. You could get into a person's computer, download information on that computer, perhaps read emails that may be stored in that computer, download other information that might be on the computer's hard drive. You could look for voicemail messages or take notes based on messages that are left on a machine, a variety of other things, and then leave the premises without actually removing anything. But it is an investigative procedure.
All right, now, but of course, you can do all of these things, but you do it without the knowledge of the individual. In other words, the individual doesn't know you've ever been there, do they?
That's right. And ordinarily, the practice was to leave a notification in the premises at the very time that the agents depart. That indicates to the person that the agents had been there, what the purpose of the investigation is, what items may have been searched for, what items may have been copied, and you know, how long the agents were there. But in the Patriot Act, that notification can be delayed for what's called a reasonable time. And the Justice Department seems to think that that could be anywhere from 7 to perhaps 30 days. So for perhaps as long as a month, an individual would not even be notified that a sneak and peek warrant had been executed in their premises.
Now, but of course, who would make the government notify them at the end of a month? Would the government be forced to do that, or does sometimes the government not abide by its own laws?
Well, of course, the part of the sneak and peek order would designate the time period at which the notification would have to be delivered. But that is an interesting point, and it's something that I mentioned in my book, that it would be very difficult for a federal court to be tracking exactly when that notification was given and if it was given in accordance with even the delayed notification requirement.
All right. Now, of course, under the sneak and peek, isn't it possible under certain provisions actually to take things to be used as evidence at a later date, certain specific items, without the person's knowledge?
Yeah, even though the sneak and peek warrant is supposed to be a non-physical search warrant, there is an exception in the Patriot Act for a court to even allow that kind of warrant to be executed, although certain items might actually be seized. So that is, in a sense, an end around the Fourth Amendment.
In other words, basically they can come in to your home without your knowledge or consent and take things from your home and not tell you about it, and supposedly they're supposed to tell you about it, but we find that sometimes in their anxiousness or in the desire to carry out the law, or for whatever reason, why they may or may not tell you at the specific time they're supposed to, and then who holds police officers responsible for violating the laws or the rights of the individual? Because certainly the Fourth Amendment was to prevent this sort of thing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. The Fourth Amendment specifically relates to unreasonable searches and seizures by government agents.
And, of course, doesn't this really negate the Fourth Amendment?
I think it is a very serious erosion of Fourth Amendment protections.
Now, of course, this idea of these type of searches, wasn't a lot of this related to laws that had been passed previously? For instance, there was a law passed in 1996 having to do with foreign surveillance or foreign terrorism, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know the name of that law. But, of course, in 1996, Congress was told, there's a terrible threat from international terrorism. You've got to give government all sorts of additional laws. What was that law about? That isn't actually the U.S. Patriot Act, just a compilation of a lot of these previously existing laws that the government refused to enforce or utilize?
Well, one of the 1996 law they may be talking about, it was the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, which did allow for additional searches and surveillance powers, but nowhere near to the extent that the Patriot Act does. There was also the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed sooner than that, and the date escapes me right now. It may have been in the late 70s or early 80s, which established something called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, that is to review search and seizure or surveillance warrants directed solely toward foreign intelligence surveillance that was not supposed to be criminal investigations or criminal prosecutions, but looking at agents of a foreign power that might be operating in the United States. So those powers already existed. And I don't think the Patriot Act could be seen simply as a piecing together of laws, of maybe leftover provisions that hadn't been enacted yet, or certain things that the government might have been thinking about but hadn't introduced in the Congress. Some of this material obviously was around before September 11th, but there are some new provisions and an entire whole, once you consider the entire Patriot Act, because it's 10 titles and it's 150 sections, that really moves existing law over to the next horizon.
Well, of course, one of the things that caused people a great deal of concern is the ability now for the FBI to tap telephones, read emails, mm-hmm. Read faxes. And now, in the past, they had to get a special sort of warrant for this, didn't they?
Right.
Was that from the
warrant.
Secret Court? What's the secret court they talk about?
Well, that's the division that's now part of the big debate about what the Patriot Act does. Federal agencies and FBI, for example, had authority to tap telephones for many years under laws as old as the Omnibus Crime and Safe Speech Act of back in the Johnson administration and earlier. But now surveillance authority granted under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act goes even farther, because the objective of those surveillance activities is not necessarily a criminal prosecution. So the standards for issuance of those warrants and the extent of the surveillance could be broader, because even though the Fourth Amendment protections were not necessarily being followed, it wasn't a great concern because criminal prosecution was not going to be the end result of those surveillance activities. Now, however, under the Patriot Act, those Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act authorities are being expanded. And the Justice Department is starting to argue that surveillance results that come from those activities might be usable in a criminal prosecution.
All right.
Which breaks down the barrier between the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act kind of activity and the other activity that goes from the standard wiretap search and seizure authorities from other criminal statutes, which is supposed to follow Fourth Amendment guidelines.
Well, first, now, is there concern that this could be used against American citizens who are just concerned about the excesses of government? And haven't we seen this in the past where misuse of federal power has been used against law-abiding citizens, and yet, of course, many times just for dissent, for disagreeing with government policy, Americans have been arrested and imprisoned?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, there was a whole scandal back in the 60s and 70s of the FBI's COINTELPRO programs that investigated all kinds of people from Martin Luther King on down. And there was scandals involving excesses of FBI authorities in the 70s and CIA authorities in the 70s. But this new situation goes even, I think, farther than that, because not only do those kinds of authorities now coming back, as a matter of fact, Ashcroft some months ago announced a relaxation of FBI surveillance rules that will almost bring us back to the kind of situation we were in back in the 60s and 70s in terms of FBI surveillance powers. But not only do we have that, but we have a new policy under the Patriot Act of information sharing between the FBI, CIA, and almost every other federal law enforcement and investigative agency, and that would include the DEA, the ATF, the Secret Service, Treasury agents, IRS, and so on. I mean, you can name several of these federal agencies that are now going to be mandated to share information so long as it relates to terrorism or foreign intelligence. And foreign intelligence can mean a lot of things, as defined in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and that definition is borrowed and incorporated into the Patriot Act. It could mean anything involving the foreign affairs of the United States, and that's not necessarily restricted to aliens or foreign nationals operating in the United States.
And, of course, the fear is that this is certainly is not about Islamic terrorism. It's about domestic dissent. Now, what about forfeiture? Because I think that people have to understand that traditionally when the king wanted to destroy his opposition, he would impose forfeiture. This was certainly used by the ancient English kings. It was used for pirates. And if somebody was accused of being a pirate, then everything they had could be seized. Well, of course, we adopted it here in America as part of our war against drugs. Of course, I'd like to suggest we're fighting the war against drugs the way we fought the war in Vietnam. We're really not trying to win it very hard. If we were, we're doing a terrible job. If we're not trying to win it very hard, we're doing an excellent job. But forfeiture has been sort of accepted in that. I mean, we've got the wicked drug users, and so we're going to make them forfeit their property. But the trouble is, if I own a house and somebody's renting my house and somebody is smoking marijuana or dealing marijuana from my house, they can seize my house even though I have nothing to do with it. How could that be?
Well, let's look at be shown that there was some knowledge that you had, that there was some connection between your permitting the house to be used for drug manufacturer sales. Even though you might not have known exactly precisely what was going on, you had opportunity to know, and you never took advantage of that opportunity. It could make you an accessory after the fact or even a co-conspirator.
Yes, but don't I have to prove that I didn't know rather than they have to prove that I did know?
That's right.
In other words, you're guilty until proven innocent rather than innocent until proven guilty.
In many forfeiture cases, that's correct.
And isn't it true then that in many of these, and we're talking about drugs now, many of those forfeiture cases, they'll come in and take all the money out of your bank account and seize your physical assets, and then you don't have any money to hire a lawyer to get your property back, which was taken from you unfairly. Haven't innocent people lost their property under these forfeiture acts in the past?
Well, I'm sure that's been the case overall. And what's happened in the Patriot Act is forfeiture, civil forfeiture, as ordinarily as applied in drug cases, related to proceeds of the crime itself. That is, property that was purchased by the proceeds of illegal acts such as narcotics trafficking, or the money that was obtained in the activity itself. Now, however, the Patriot Act allows for forfeiture to go beyond that to reach property or monies that may not necessarily be related to the criminal act or didn't have a direct connection to the criminal act. And that is the forfeiture of estate that you were mentioning, which was often occurred in the common law of England, and that the Constitution and then the early sessions of Congress specifically outlawed. And it appears that the Patriot Act might actually be bringing forfeiture of estate back into the criminal system.
Well,
would you explain that?
Would you explain forfeiture of estate? Because for our listeners, they may not know that term.
Yeah. Well, as we were just discussing, forfeiture of estate would mean forfeiting property that may belong to you, but is part of your estate, but is not necessarily connected to the crime at which you're charged with. If you're a drug dealer, for example, and you made $100,000 selling drugs, and that money's in your bank account, it could be traced directly to the illegal action that you were charged with, then that money could be seized under standard forfeiture procedures. Now with the Patriot Act, it's possible that forfeiture could be expanded to other monies and other properties that would be in your possession but were not necessarily connected to the crime. And that is a newer approach to forfeiture, which actually brings back the ancient forfeiture of estate practices that were outlawed in the Constitution.
So, of course, it really is the definition of terrorism, and of course the definition of terrorism has changed, and but it's really not specific Islamic terrorism. It is any act of terrorism or effort to change what's going on in government that could be considered by coercion as an act of terrorism on the part of the individual. So my concern is that they are using the attack on September 11th to change the entire structure of the laws of the country.
Well, September 11th obviously has been a watershed for congressional legislation and criminal law and many other areas of government, down to military tribunals and the Office of Homeland Security and a variety of other things that we could name. But certainly with the Patriot Act, it's very obvious that federal agencies are transforming themselves, and the relationship between federal agencies and the citizenry is starting to morph into something beyond that which we knew before.
Well, of course, we know that with the Office of Homeland Security, they're talking about having a more federal control over the local police, which, of course, was never what it was supposed to be. We were never even supposed to have a federal police. We were supposed to have a state and a local police, but we were never have a federal police force. That was what Gestapos are made of. But it seems that we're expanding federal police, and then, of course, they're going to be able to put out more or less directions to the local police, and the local police more or less merging with their computers and all to the federal police. Is anybody concerned about this sort of thing?
Well, I think they should be, because there's new mandated policies in the Patriot Act, for example, for cross-agency training between the CIA, the FBI, and state and local governments about terrorism, so that state and local government and law enforcement at the local level can be more involved in terrorism investigations. There's new mandated grants to state and local governments for terrorism readiness plans. There's been a new initiative in the Department of Homeland Security under a new document that's just been issued called the National Strategy for Homeland Security to get state and local governments more involved at the federal level of investigating and maybe preventing terrorism. But the problem is that state and local governments are not always that well trained. They have other things to do. They don't have unlimited resources. And they may not go about these procedures as carefully. and that's a very odd word to be using, given the new authorities at the federal level, as the federal government might do, you know.
Have you ever seen the pamphlet that was distributed in the Phoenix area by the Joint Terrorism Task Force in 1999?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
If you ever have a chance, go up to my website. I have it posted there. It's really rather unbelievable. In fact, we actually had to call the telephone numbers and the people who are named on this to be sure this was true. But they had a joint terrorism task force in Phoenix in 1999. And, of course, they listed, it said, you know, if you see any of these, report it to your local joint terrorism task force. And they listed the names of a couple of sheriffs and somebody in the police department, somebody in the FBI. And then how do you tell a terrorist? Well, they talk about the Constitution, and they want to use it to restrict the power of the federal government or the United Nations. They talk about the restrictive their rights under the Constitution, and they may very well say that they aren't required to have a driver's license. They may belong to some sort of a doomsday group. In fact, I was called by a FBI agent immediately after the September 11th attack, a man who said that he was from the office in Oklahoma. And he asked me about if I believed that these are the end times. Now, that, of course, is a term that an evangelical Christian understands. It's been the belief since the time of the disciples, St. Paul and St. Peter, that that Christ was going to come again. But why an FBI agent would ask anybody about their religious beliefs? He didn't ask if I was an Islamic terrorist. He wanted to know if I believed these were the end times. I called him back recently. I remembered his name, and I asked him why he was asking these questions. And all he would say was, "You aren't being investigated." I said, "But why do you want to know about my Christian beliefs?" "Well, you aren't being investigated." Well, I really am concerned that there may be some overzealous people in our government who are concerned, as they are in this joint terrorism task force in Phoenix in 1999. And incidentally, any of our listeners, go up to my website. It's radioliberty.com, and we have it posted up there. Why are they so concerned about people who talk about the Constitution and are concerned about excessive use of power by the federal government?
Well, obviously, this is part of the problem that we've got, is that new powers that are granted are much more likely to be abused. The more power an agency has, the greater the chances are that abuse of that power will occur, and the greater chances that there are that a federal agent or an agent in charge or an FBI bureau may go off on some tangent about what they consider to be terrorism or who they decide they're going to round up under the overall rubric or definition of what might be a terrorist. And this Patriot Act, especially since much of the authorities that are given by it is permanent, is just going to be with us for a long time, and we're going to have all kinds of instances of abuse of authority in the under the guise of investigating terrorism.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned that sometimes that they can the federal police can do things without a court order. Under what circumstances could they tap telephones or read emails or read faxes without a court order?
Well, that kind of search and surveillance authority, I think, still is going to need a court order. Even under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, you would need a court order to do telephone tapping or tapping voicemail, email, that sort of kind of electronic investigation. But under the Patriot Act, a federal agent can certify the importance of obtaining a consumer record, consumer financial report, bank records, bank reports, account history, educational records, criminal background, of employment histories, any number of things that may involve even more personal items than what a person may be saying to somebody on the telephone. And all of that could be done without a court order.
All right, fine. Well, our guest this evening is C. William Michaels. His book, No Greater Threat. And we're carrying that, and we're going to let you know how to get hold of his website. The book is available, of course, by calling our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Would you like to give out your website and telephone number if people want to get in touch with you?
The best way to take a look at what the book does and to get an author bio, maybe post a comment about the book and order it if you wish, is to go to the book's special website, and that is www.nogreaterthreat.com, www.nogreaterthreat.com, and there's a description of what the book is. It's also available to order through Barnes & Noble and Amazon, as well as through your website and the website I just mentioned.
All right, we're going to be back here in just 3 minutes. If you'd like to get a cup of coffee or a drink of water, when we get back, of course, we'll invite your calls at 464-8295 or out across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-245-4237. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, and on our weekend programs. And our weekend programs are heard on almost 40 stations, maybe even a little over 40 stations every weekend. I guess about 40 stations. And of course, some of it's our program, some of it's our half-hour program. But we have an opportunity to reach out across America. 5 hours every day on the Internet, 5 hours every day on a radio station someplace across America, 3 hours on satellite, 2 hours on shortwave. What a unique opportunity to bring people the truth they're not going to get. And, of course, interesting guests like we have this evening who have really studied these issues and, of course, are equally concerned to you and I about what's going on. People don't understand that liberty and limited government are synonymous. And, of course, the reason America was founded was because of the excesses of the British Crown. And yet, of course, today, excesses of our current administration and past administrations, for that matter, far exceed that of the British Crown as far as the efforts to circumvent the rule of law and impose the will of the ruling class on the people, always in the name, of course, of fighting Islamic terrorism. But, of course, as we pointed out, that the USA Patriot Act never once mentions Islamic terrorism. So you have to understand that they've broadened the definition of terrorism. They've failed to mention Islamic terrorism. And, of course, anybody in the listening audience, under one or another circumstance, perhaps as they have defined it by the Joint Task Force down there in Phoenix, why, you believe in the Constitution. You talk about the Constitution. Aha! Well, you may not believe this is true. And if you don't have access to the Internet, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll send you a copy of that FBI pamphlet. I can assure you it's true. I've had two friends who've called the people in the sheriff's office who are very, very embarrassed about having gone along with this and gone along with the local FBI agent who really, of course, believes that those of us who believe in the Constitution, who fear excesses by government, are really terrorists and should be reported to the local task force. So you have to understand that freedom is lost when good people do nothing. And if you want to join in this epic struggle to try to preserve our freedom, whether it be on the left or right, I think everybody really who values freedom has to be involved. And the only way we're going to change anything is to inform the American people and let them understand other than when good people do nothing, why people with another agenda take control. And so if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family and partner with us in our efforts, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is truly at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is C. William Michaels, and Mr. Michaels is an attorney. He lives back in New York, and he's kind enough to stay up here after 11:30 as we talk about his book, No Greater Threat. And I think it's an important book, which is why we're carrying it. And as he mentioned, it's available on the Barnes & Nobles and Amazon.com and through his website, or if you'd like to call us, you may. And, of course, our telephone number, if you'd like to talk to Mr. Michaels, if you have any questions or comment on what we're talking about, it is, of course, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-245-4237, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And as you actually read the provisions of this bill, and I will tell you there's no way that this bill was all written, in this very, very short period of time between the anthrax attack, when they closed down the Congressional Office Building and I think the Senate's Office Building, and everybody in Washington, D.C. is living in terror. And, of course, the time it is forced through Congress and nobody is allowed to read it. Ron Paul, a congressman back there, commented that no member of Congress was allowed to read the bill. It was just a matter of patriotism. You vote for it because we got to take care of these wicked terrorists. but it doesn't even mention the wicked terrorist in there. It simply expands the definition of terrorism, and of course is being used against anyone who isn't going along with this idea that is so prevalent within the ruling elite for a new world order and, of course, a new world religion going along with that. And then, of course, it was passed in the Senate, and the following day the president signed this. And 46 days after the September 11th attack, this was the new law of the land. And as I said earlier, it contained many of the provisions that Bill Clinton tried to get through, and Bill Clinton could get them through, but of course the current administration did. And really what it does is a massive expansion of police power by the executive branch of government. Now, as far as these special warrants that they have. Basically, how do they get these? They go to this, what is the secret court that they go to? And then, they, of course, they ask for a warrant to allow them to go in and do a sneak and peek search or begin to tap telephones. And of course, is it different? My understanding is that, at least in the past, those courts have given, the warrants, anybody, all they had to do was ask for it, so they could get it. Yeah.
Yes, I think the court that you're mentioning is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, which was designed under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to review requests for search and surveillance orders to investigate by federal authorities people who may be agents of a foreign power, foreign nationals, or aliens operating in the United States, where the purpose of the investigation was not necessarily criminal prosecution. And in the entire, I think, maybe 15-year history of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, it has denied just one of the search and seizure surveillance requests that have been submitted to it.
Well, of course, there was some talk recently that at least one or several of the judges were very unhappy, pointing out that the FBI had lied to get these, get the permission, that on 75 different times, federal officials had lied, FBI agents had lied to the court to get these warrants, and the judges were a little unhappy about that. But of course, if you or I were to lie to a federal official, we'd go to prison.
Right.
If you're an FBI official and you lie, why, that's perfectly all right, you get a promotion. There's something wrong with this picture.
That, I would totally agree with that. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court issued an opinion just a few months ago, which is one of the rare events. Most of its opinions or decisions are not made public, and some of them, in fact, are even classified. And that decision was quite a broadside against several FBI agents who had been submitting what appears to be either incomplete or inaccurate or just downright false information in a variety of cases stretching over the past few years in order to get their search and seizure and surveillance orders. And I think even the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, which has apparently not had too much trouble with any of these submissions, is starting to take another look now at what's going on. And perhaps maybe one byproduct in a positive way of this Patriot Act is to bring some of this information to light. Not too many people even aware of the fact that there was such a thing called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or there was such a thing as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, and it had been operating for all these years. The fact that the Patriot Act has now made this statute and the court nationally famous, I think it's going to shed a whole new light upon its activities, and maybe we'll see some reforms along the way, but not before we see an awful lot of abuse, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, one of the things that really bothers me is the fact that the current administration is refusing to abide by the law. I mean, for instance, we have the Freedom of Information Act, but the president has told government officials not to abide by the law, and they will back them up if people apply for information under the Freedom of Information Act, that if they don't give it, the administration will help them. There is suspending the Whistleblower Act, which is the law of the land, but of course they're just saying, well, we won't give the whistleblowers, people reporting corruption in government, any protection. In fact, the courts have said that they wanted to see the list of the names of all these people who've been arrested and being held secretly. Supposedly, they are all people here who are immigrants or people here. They're not U.S. citizens. And, of course, the government has said, we're not going to obey the laws put down by the court. Or on Padilla, they said, well, we want to see, he is supposedly the
dirty bomber.
Right.
Right.
We're not going to give you the information. We're not going to show you our evidence that he is a threat. Well, you know, when the administration begins to defy the courts, then, of course, we've done away with checks and balances, and we have an executive branch of government that is operating outside the law. Is anybody concerned about that?
Well, you're absolutely right, and I think that's a very slippery slope. For the government to say, after the district court finally ruled in favor of several groups and detainees who had been seeking information about those who had been arrested, after the court had ruled that those detainee names had to be released, for the government to then say that we're not going to do that in the interest of national security, we think the court is wrong, and we refuse to abide by it pending appeal, which an appeal, as you know, could go on for years, I think that's a very serious and a very disturbing kind of action by our federal government.
And, of course, this idea of saying that as far as the idea that, you know, an American citizen, once he is labeled an enemy combatant, and whatever that is, that's not defined, but once we label him an enemy combatant, then, of course, he no longer has the right of habeas corpus, the right to a speedy trial, the right to consult with his lawyer. And, of course, there are several people being held under that guise. But, you know,
and Padilla is one of them.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, that is a wrinkle, talk about abuse of power, that is not even mentioned in the Patriot Act, this idea that an enemy combatant, once that label has been placed on somebody by the federal government, can be held indefinitely. I mean, that's not even in the Code of Military Justice. So I don't know where the federal government is getting this idea, but several people who have been detained have now been deemed to be enemy combatants, and that supposedly means that they could be held without charge, without ability to seek counsel, without ability to present their own defense, apparently without, as you mentioned, the right of habeas corpus to challenge their detention, and on an indefinite basis. This is virtually unheard of in the American criminal justice system.
Well, of course, in the past, though, and of course, the first part of your book, which I thought was really fascinating, go into the history of the things that have happened in the past. And there's always been people in the federal government who didn't want all these restrictions as represented by the Bill of Rights. They really wanted an all-powerful central government, and haven't there time and time again through the years, and especially in times of war, or of a supposed external threat, people misused the power of government to crush any opposition or anyone they didn't like?
Oh, well, that's gone all the way back almost to the founding of the Republic and the original Alien and Sedition Acts. We see some abuse of power, 200 years ago in that situation. Well, those acts eventually were repealed. But then we had later Alien and Sedition Acts that were passed around the time of World War One. We have the House Un-American Activities Committee, which destroyed many careers in the attempt to root out communism. However, you know, noble that cause might have been, I think there were many people who, were terribly damaged in that process. There was the FBI activity under the COINTELPRO programs. There was the Comstock Law, the Palmer Raids. I mean, there's a whole collection, and there the detention of Japanese Americans on the West Coast during World War II, which action, by the way, was affirmed by the Supreme Court. All these things have been part of our history, and not very happy part of our history. But I think, unfortunately, that wheel is coming around again, and we're seeing a whole new wave of new federal investigative powers, surveillance activities, detention activities, and, this new idea of enemy combatants, military tribunals, any number of things you may want to mention that are coming to light because of this new sense of threat.
And, of course, when you have an enemy, or at least you presume you have an enemy, and that, of course, is Islamic terrorism. And then, of course, you have to pass all sorts of laws to restrict the rights of law-abiding citizens to protect society against the wicked Islamic terrorists. Mm-hmm. But, certainly as we see the restructuring of government with the Office of Homeland Security, and, of course, the frightening thing about that is It removes the checks and balances of our legislative branch of government. In other words, no longer will Congress have the power to counter the executive branch of government. And you know what the most interesting thing is? All the news reports coming out all across, and I read about six or seven newspapers every day, and of course they all tell you that the debate in the Senate has to do with civil rights protection. Pardon me, not civil rights, but civil service protection for the people in the...
Well, that's the debate over right. The Department of Homeland Security.
That isn't what it's all about at all. It's about this usurpation of power and the destruction of checks and balances. And if you read what Senator Byrd is saying, and it has nothing to do with what you read in the newspaper. In other words, the newspaper is really not telling us that there are at least a few people in the Senate and the House of Representatives who are frightened to death that we're moving towards a constitutional dictatorship, but that's never mentioned. We're supposed to believe mm-hmm. that the debate has to do with civil service protection. And if you can't get the truth as an American citizen from the newspapers, where will you get the truth?
Well, it's going to be hard to find, especially because I mentioned in my book that one of the characteristics of a national security state is media in the service of the state. And I fear to say that some of the major commercial network media has been far too easy on all of this and has not been very careful in reporting the abuses of power that are underway under the Patriot Act, or done a very good job in explaining to the American people what the Patriot Act has done.
All right, now you keep referring to in your book, and I think it's a great term, the national security state. Why don't you sort of develop that idea? Because I think it's so important our listeners understand what you're talking about.
Well, a national security state is a kind of government which has become completely obsessed with and totally concerned, almost to the exclusion of all else, with the concept as that government sees it of national security. So that government resources, legislation, court decisions, executive orders, federal investigative power, the relationship between the government and the citizenry, all combine to move in advance this concept of national security almost into every phase of governmental life and then almost every phase of social life. A national security state, therefore, would be completely opposed to and would deal severely with folks who oppose it, who dissent from it, who attempt to protect civil liberties against it, and I think civil liberties and a variety of other protections begin to fall as the government becomes even more and more concerned with this concept of national security, to the point where it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, that national security becomes an even greater concern of government, and there never seems to be enough ways that you can achieve your national security objective, and then pretty soon there is almost nothing left in the life of government except this, and it becomes almost an all-consuming enterprise.
All right, let's go to Bill, who's calling from Pasco, Washington. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing fine. A question or comment?
I just wanted to make a comment about the media. I noticed you mentioned the media. The New York Times, especially, and all of our major broadcast stations, they seem to really bound the debate between Majority Leader Senator Daschle and President Bush as if they were actually arguing about something. I turned on the television yesterday, and Mr. Daschle voted for that resolution just the same as all the other people who are pro-war. And anybody who was actually against the war, like Senator Byrd or Representative Ron Paul, they were just relegated to the back pages.
Either that or you never even hear what they have to say. Although, to the credit of the New York Times, they did actually reprint Senator Byrd's speech, and I will tell you it was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant speech, but I'm sure you never heard it on television. As you were talking about why we should be concerned about going to war.
Exactly. It's because...
But you see, everybody what you do is if all the media is in favor of war and you don't want to go along with it, somehow you're sort of an odd person. And of
course, unpatriotic all of a sudden.
Right, and of course the thing is, who is against the war? Well, I will tell you, the communists have organized demonstrations all across America against the war. I know because I read the communist publications. So they've got their people out in the streets demonstrating, and then they got Barbara Streisand and a couple of other people we don't like, and they're against the war, and we certainly don't want to be on their side, do we? And so we are manipulated into supporting a war that, if we stopped and thought about it, we never would support at all.
Well, also, I'd like to mention, too, that there are people on the left, too, like Ralph Nader, who are against the war, and I wouldn't necessarily say that they're communists.
Well, of course they're not. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody against the war. I'm against the war. I suspect that our guest this evening, Mr. Michaels, is against the war, aren't you?
I've been against a lot of wars, including this one.
All right, fine. So, Mr. Michaels on the left side, but that doesn't mean we don't agree on most issues. So, but what they are doing, my point is, Bill, that what they do is they've got people out there that we ordinarily, if they're sort of dirty and they got long hair and we don't want to associate with them, and they take one position, so we automatically take the opposite. This is how they stage manage the Vietnam War, and we have to go. You're probably not. Are you old enough to remember Vietnam?
Well, actually, yeah. I've been doing a lot of reading about it, and I've read books by Noam Chomsky about the Vietnam War, and he's another person. I mean, you might not agree with everything he says, but there's a lot of. I mean, I listen to everybody from Chuck Missler to Noam Chomsky to all the great minds, and I think. The main thing is a lot of people need to realize that really it's all people who are for peace, for peaceful measures against people who are for violence and manipulating the population through weapons manufacturers and everything else. I go on a
Well, okay, why don't you get my video? I think it's called What's Little Known About the Causes of Wars and Revolutions. It's a video, but it'll explain to you what Vietnam was all about. And believe me, it was never about defeating communism. Hey,
never
we got
about
a run. But thanks so much, and I'm going to tell, next time I talk to Chuck Missler, I'm going to tell him you put him in the category of great minds. He is a great mind, and he's a good friend.
Okay, great.
God bless you, Bill. Thanks
you
so much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, the nice thing about what we do is we've got people from all sorts of the political spectrum listening to our programs, and they will agree with some. They'll disagree with others. But we're involved in a battle of ideas, but at least they'll hear both sides of the issue. At least they'll hear our side, and then they can get the media side, and hopefully they'll come up with the truth.
And this, to me, I think, is going to be the challenge among the activist movements on both sides of the spectrum as this Patriot Act begins to unfold. We're seeing the one-year anniversary come around in a couple of weeks, and we've got many more years of this thing to go. And I think it's going to be very easy for government and the people in power to start playing the left and the right off against each other while the bigger picture gets lost. And so I think that the left has to realize that maybe Orrin Hatch can be right about a couple of things, and the right wing has to realize that maybe Ted Kennedy can be right about a couple of things, and maybe we'll get to breaking down these artificial divisions that have arisen around issues and people and start getting to the bigger questions of what kind of society this is becoming.
Well, I'm sure the left demonizes Orrin Hatch and the right demonizes Ted Kennedy. But, of course, it is this old idea of manipulating people and, of course, demonizing anybody who really tells the truth.
Mm-hmm. So, and as I said before, the enemy isn't Orrin Hatch or Ted Kennedy. The enemy is apathy. The enemy is ignorance. The enemy is people who are not paying attention. And this is the great grist of the national security state is a compliant and placid citizenry that is in total agreement with whatever the government does. That is a recipe for disaster.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I can have a lot more respect for Ted Kennedy, who I would disagree with, than I do for the vast majority of people who really don't want to be involved, really don't care. And, of course, at least the liberal, many of them, are so dedicated they're willing to get in and do something. And I would have far more respect for them than I would for the average individual. I remember what Whitaker Chambers has said about Alger Hiss, and somebody had asked him if he hated Alger Hiss. And for those of you who don't remember why, Whitaker Chambers had identified Alger Hiss as a member of the Communist Party. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Whitaker Chambers said, I could never hate a man who agreed with me that the life is not worth living, for which a man is not willing to die at any moment. And, of course, Hiss was willing to die for what he believed in. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with that, and I would respect Alger Hiss, though I would disagree with him. So, anyway...
That was the Great House Un-American Activities Committee investigation that brought Richard Nixon to prominence.
Of course it was, but, of course, if you read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, if you'd like, I'll send you one. Basically, I point out that communism was created to create an enemy. You have to have an enemy to rally the people against. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you get the people who support it, you get the people who oppose it, but, of course, people never understand who provided the funding for communism at that time and who it is who's providing the funding for communist China and for Russia today and who's pouring money into both of those societies, creating the best enemies money can buy. Well, but that's a little off our subject for this evening. We're just about out of time. What message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
I would hope that the listeners to this program and other people who may get the book and start reading it would be more well informed of what the Patriot Act has done, what direction this country is headed in terms of a potential involvement of or transformation into a national security state. I'm hoping that people will start taking these concerns to heart, decide for themselves how they may want to respond to that, what they may want to do. There are certain activities that are going to be happening in the year 2005, and it's really not that far away in terms of the Patriot Act itself. And I describe those events in the book that we have to watch out for. We have to be very, very careful as we see governmental authority, investigative and surveillance powers start to move forward through the Patriot Act, and we see these abuses starting to pop up in news reports or court decisions, and really try to get involved, stay involved, keep track of these issues, because an informed and an active citizenry is the best defense against abuse of power.
It's the only defense we have. God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us.
All right.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Okay.
All right. This is Dr. Stan. And, of course, the book is important, and that's why we're going to carry it. It's called No Greater Threat. And, of course, the background of the book is simply this, that the author has gone through this tedious bill and given you the background, the understanding of what all these various sections are, so that you can discuss it and discuss it intelligently. And I will tell you, as you read this, why it's awfully easy to get lost, but, as you get the copies of a program, and we're glad to give you a free copy of this radio program, if you'd like, if you decide to get the book through Radio Liberty. Again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, we're going to have to say good night to our listeners up there in the great state of Washington and Oregon and Idaho, and pray for America. Pray that we don't go into this war, which I believe will lead to the Third World War. And, of course, remember our ministry, Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and protection. Well, good evening again. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 1-888-245-4237, or here in the Central Coast of California at 424-8295. But right now, of course, 464-8295. I'm sorry. That's 464-8295. But right now, of course, I'm going to be talking to Dr. R. L. Hymers, Jr. about his book, Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. And, of course, somebody had commented, one of the news magazines, that if you looked at the smoke of the World Trade Center, you could see the face of Satan there glaring at you. Dr. Hymers, are you there yet?
Yes.
All right, fine. And, of course, you have on the front page of your book a picture of the World Trade Center in flames. And of course, if you sort of look over on the side, why, you see a picture that, well, it could be the Satan looking down, an evil-looking creature with a pointed beard staring out over the city.
Yes.
But, of course, your basic theme is you not putting any credence in the way the smoke curls, but you believe that what we are seeing and what we saw on September 11th of last year was a satanic act. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. One of the tabloids printed that photograph, and I'm not sure actually whether it was doctored or not, but I looked at it carefully and I thought, you know, that would be a tremendous title for this book, because whether or not the smoke curled into the face of Satan is irrelevant. As we were watching that on television, we could feel in our home as we were watching those planes, and they kept showing it over and over, those planes flying into the World Trade Center, and they showed that shot over and over. And I began to feel actually kind of sick at the stomach watching it, because the whole thing was demonic.
Oh, there's no question it was. And, of course, we were being manipulated by the television studios. We saw that over and over and over and over again.
It's like a brainwashing.
Well, of course it was. I mean, in fact, it was probably not until the next day when I began to recover from the shock of what I'd seen. And I saw how they were using the music and the pictures of the weeping people and, you know, bloodstained faces. And I suddenly realized, we're being manipulated. I mean, this is almost like somebody is orchestrating everything I'm seeing on television to control my reality, to give me a perception. And, of course, we always start our program with reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it will be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I said, this is all perception. I mean,
yes.
A terrible tragedy. People are dead. And, of course, initially it was 6,000 people died, and then it was 5,500 people died, and then it was 5,000 people died, and then it was 4,500 people died. And, well, it ended up, it was about 3,000 people. And that's a terrible, terrible tragedy.
Well, of course, that's what television does. I never watch the news on television. One of the reasons is I get several newspapers, and then several, like the Washington Times and so forth, and I get my news through that, because the television has a way of manipulating the basic, because it focuses on one thing. For instance, when we had the riots here in Los Angeles, it seemed like the whole city was on fire, and people said to me, your whole city has exploded. Well, of course, that's not true. I flew in on an airplane up over the city when we had the big riot here, and I could see from the airplane a few spots that were on fire. And then somebody came in the car, got me in the car, and I've had people say, how did you do that? We had a prayer meeting right in our church, which is in downtown Los Angeles, during the riot, the second day of the riot, and everybody drove in, everybody drove out, but the news made it seem like the whole city was on fire, and that's what I think has happened with the World Trade Center here. I do believe that there is something demonic connected with it, and particularly in connection with the Muslim religion. My associate and I, Dr. John S. Waldrop, sat down and we took a whole bunch of books on Islam, and we really studied it quite deeply. We interviewed a lot of people, and we put together this book. The first half of it is on demons. I wrote that, demonology. And the second half of the book is on Islam. The two really do connect together because the Muslim religion is demonic.
No question. In fact, you had this wonderful, wonderful quotation on page 4, and I thought it was really so so striking, and I have it underlined and marked. Islam is a religion in which God requires you to send your son to die for him.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity is a faith in which God sends his son to die for you.
Yes, of course, that John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft said that. It was quoted by Cal Thomas.
Islam is a religion in which God requires you to send your son to die for him.
That's right.
Christianity is a faith in which God sends his son to die for you. That is beautifully, beautifully said.
Yeah, that was Ashcroft, John Ashcroft's evaluation, and I think he was exactly right on that. What we do in chapter one, chapter one of the book is called Satan Attacks America. We show where the demons came from and how people become demon-possessed. And that alone is, to me, a very fascinating subject, and it's one that isn't touched on enough in our pulpits. You know, we want to be positive, but you sometimes have to present the negative for the positive to be understood.
Well, of course, as you point out, so we really don't talk very much about heaven, and we certainly don't talk much about hell today. And
no.
We certainly don't talk about Satan, and we don't talk about demons.
Right.
And, of course, that first section of the book that gets in the background of fallen angels and demons, and they're not imaginary. They're not something you simply see on the X-Files. They're real, and of course they possess people in America today. That's the frightening thing. In fact, of course, as we those people who listen to our programs regularly will know that we say that these demonic forces work within both the Republicans and the Democrat parties. whether it's Hillary Clinton inviting Gene Houston to the White House to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi, or Nancy Reagan being there consulting her astrology and getting the information to Ronald Reagan on a regular basis. We have a bipartisan occultism working in the very highest levels of our government today. And as you point out in your book, so well, of course, why the devil offered Jesus all of the kingdoms of this world if he'd fall down and worship him, because the devil controlled all the governments of the world. That was all the kingdoms of the world.
And
that is the
sense,
message, and it's been forgotten.
Yeah, in some sense, Doc, everybody that is not converted is under the control of the devil. The Bible says, calls him the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. And every unconverted person is more or less, to a greater or lesser extent, controlled by the demonic. And even Christians can be confused and led astray. I give here, for instance, from John Nevius. Dr. Nevius was a Presbyterian, a very, very conservative Presbyterian missionary to Korea, and then to China, and he wrote a book, a very famous and classical book, Demon Possession and Allied Themes, published by Fleming Ravel in 1894. And this book is a treasure in itself. We give here what he says demons are able to do, and 14 points, including levitation, lifting people up, wrappings, many of these things are going on right now. I saw on Larry King Live the last few months two mediums on two different occasions, women that were in contact with the dead. Now there's a program, what is the name of that? Maybe you've seen it. There's a program every week where a man contacts the dead, so-called.
I don't know that.
There's a new program on that.
I wouldn't be surprised. We have a woman who appears as a guest on our program, and sometimes they even do programs here for us when I'm not here. And they're in a deliverance ministry, and she was telling me that within the last month or so, they were dealing with this man who is demonically possessed, and he was actually levitating in their living room. These are not imaginary things, ladies and gentlemen. Satan is alive, and he's well, and his dominions and his demons are here, and they're living among us, of course. And they are possessing people, and of course they're searching for the souls of as many as they can reach. And this is not just a bland claim. This is the reality of where we are today, and you can't understand. And, of course, the reason I enjoyed your book so much, Doctor, was the fact that our recurrent theme on Radio Liberty is you can't understand anything going on unless you understand that behind the political, behind the educational, behind the philosophical and ideological is the spiritual, and it's a spiritual battle, not a political, ideological, or cultural battle.
Absolutely. And I like what you said. We're not talking about the Democrats or the Republicans. We're talking about something bigger than that. And in this book, we point out that the enemy is not Islam. You see, the enemy is not the Arab people. That's the idea. The enemy is the devil and the principalities and powers of the demonic realm, not the people themselves. And that's one of the great distinctions I think we have to make today, or otherwise we're going to go around mad at somebody, at people all the time. And that's not the way to win people to Christ. I was just talking to a preacher today, this morning, who recently led a young Muslim man to Christ. And he was able to do that because he could see that this young man was not his enemy, that he was, in fact, himself a dupe or you might say a puppet of the devil. And that's the way our book comes into it. We're not blaming the Arab people at all. We're blaming the devil and the demons for these things. The book is called Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. And in just a minute, I'll tell you how you can get it.
Actually, we're going to be offering that to our ministry.
Oh, you're offering
we're
it to your ministry.
We're going to offer that to our ministry because I think it's an important book. And so one of the things, of course, I think that somebody had suggested, one way to get back at the Arabs would be to bomb Mecca and Medina and destroy, of course, the Kaaba stone there in Mecca. And somebody, of course, had written me an email and said, look, that's not the approach that a Christian should take. Don't bomb Mecca with an atom bomb. Bomb it with Bibles. I mean, if we're going to change people's hearts, and win them to Christ, we're not going to do it by using force, but by Christian love. And I thought, what a beautiful point that was.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. Bombing Mecca, it should be a last resort, and I mean last.
Well, I really think that's up to God to
yes,
to do
you're
that
exactly
rather than
right.
Us.
You're exactly right. The book is Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. And the first half of the book I wrote, called The Invasion of Evil Spirits, Chapter 1, Satan's Attack on America, Chapter 2, How Demons Have Gotten Control of Our Nation, Chapter 3, Why John Walker Lind Joined the Muslims to Fight the USA. That's a young man that became a Muslim, went over there to Afghanistan, and actually fought against the United States, and they just recently gave him, I think last week, just a few days ago, they gave him a 20-year sentence for that. Of course, he'll get about 10 years.
Well, why don't you sort of develop that idea? Because I was very interested in your discussion of him and of Padilla, who the dirty bombers.
Yes.
But, why would these young people from America want to embrace the Islamic religion? And I thought you brought it out so beautifully. Why don't you, would you mind telling that story?
Oh, no, not at all. I went to Golden Gate Seminary in Marin County, and that's where this boy was raised, is up there in Marin, north of where you are. And that's a very, like many places in America, it's very culturally cold. You can do whatever you want, but the parents are, the father's gone this way, the mother's gone that way. And the boy's left there alone. They pulled him out of school back in Massachusetts. They took him out here to Marin County at 10 years old. That's a traumatic experience in itself, you know, for a kid to be uprooted, moved here across the country. And then they were Catholic people. The mother decided to become a Buddhist. She went off, and she's doing her thing, and the father's doing his thing.
The father actually left the mother and went off to live with his lover.
Yeah, he did.
He
I didn't bring that up.
Right, well, I know you didn't.
I did, because I didn't know it at the time when I wrote the book. I didn't realize that he was in that relationship.
But I mean, how disillusioning. How would you like to be? Your mother's a Buddhist, your father's a homosexual, they're separated.
Right.
And what are you going to believe in? I mean, you're supposedly a Catholic, and you reject the Catholic Church. And we all need meaning, and he begins to reject America.
Right, and so this boy then is in his classroom, and in the classroom they've taken away all of the great American heroes, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, General MacArthur. There are no normal heroes. Instead, they give him a book on Malcolm X, and he reads it. And then we wonder, why did this kid become a Muslim? Well, because the only hero he was shown or given, the only role model he was given, was Malcolm X, who was the founder of the black Muslims. See? So it's no, to me, this kid was looking for, he'd come home to a lonely house. I bring out from Newsweek and Time Magazine, the loneliness, the coldness of the American spirit experience for teenagers. And in the Islamic religion, he found that he had these people coming around him, and the families were together, and he thought, this is the way to go. But, you know, it's a real snare. It's true that the American way of life is burned out, Doc, and it's true that families are ruined and burned out, but it's also true that the Islamic religion is not the answer, and we bring that out very clearly and show why it's not. This is a good book for young people to have, and they would read this book. I think they might read Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center when they wouldn't read something else. This would be a book to give to some young person. It might stop them from becoming a Muslim, because so many young people are doing that today.
But, of course, John Walker Lind is looking for something that is real, something that is structured, something that gives him something to believe in.
Right.
And at one time, Christianity offered that, and it still does. When it is, of course, is the true Christianity, not the the watered-down form of a Christianity that's taught today, feel good, you know,
right.
Claim it and name it and claim it, or whatever new brand of Christianity they have there, prosperity Christianity. But, of course, having forgotten the wonderful message of how God gave his only son to come to earth so that no one would perish, and, of course, that to him we can have eternal life. But, you know, that is not the message we preach anymore.
No.
And so he's looking for a message, and it's there. He finds it in the Islamic religion, a structured life, pray five times a day, and you are part of something that is bigger than yourself. And you are going to fight against the... And one of the things that amazed me is that he really wanted to fight against this corrupt system he saw.
Well, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And he saw what you and I see, and what many Christians see. He saw the corruption of the American system and the American way of life, and he says, maybe I should fight against this. You see, a Christian, and one of the men that we quoted here at the beginning in the introduction that was with Jerry Vines, he wrote this, Southern Baptist man, he wrote this book. He's a convert. Him and his brother are converts from Islam, and he said, you know, if a Christian bombs an abortion clinic, he is doing that against the teachings of the New Testament. But if a Muslim bombs something or blows something up, he is doing it with the full consent of the Quran. In fact, even with the encouragement of the Quran, because the Quran, of course, teaches that. And that's one of the basic differences. Christians throughout the ages have made mistakes and have caused wars and so forth, but they did it always against the teaching of the New Testament. The difference is that the Quran actually teaches jihad. It teaches holy war and condones it.
And, of course, the only way you can be sure of getting into paradise is to die in jihad, to die killing the infidel. And then, of course, the rewards are in paradise of 70 virgins or something of the sort. And they honestly believe this. I mean, this is so schooled into them that they believe if they kill themselves in the process of killing the enemies of Allah, why, of course, they have done a great and noble thing. Christianity would never, never teach anything of that sort.
And that's the reason why when they tell you, well, look, Christianity started the Crusades, but what they don't tell you, they don't remind you, and I never want to have to be an apologist or make an apology for the Crusades, because I'm not a Catholic and I'm a Baptist, and you know, like the Crusades were a Catholic thing. Baptists have never started a war that I know of, but the thing to be, in all fairness to the Catholic Church, they were taking back land that had been taken from them by the Muslims. The Muslims came in and raped and pillaged and destroyed and killed the Catholics and drove them out of those lands. And then in the Crusades, the Catholics were coming back to take the land that had been taken from them.
And, well, of course, but so, the thing was, of course, the Muslims had spread their religion by the sword. You either converted to the Muslim faith or they would kill you. That was the option. And, of course, that's not much of an option, you know. And so those who would not convert were killed.
Whereas
Christianity doesn't spread their religion that way. At least they never should. Admittedly, there have been excesses within the structure of church. But that usually is because the church has worked with government. And it has nothing to do with the individual Catholic or even the necessarily basic Catholic beliefs.
Oh, yeah.
But the corruption of a religious system that works with government to advance the cause of government, of course, creates nothing but problems.
Exactly, and that's my point. People blame the Catholic Church for the Crusades, and I think that's a mistake. I think that they were trying to take back land that had been unjustly taken from them by the sword just a few hundred years before, and somebody said to me, you know, if we're not careful, America could be taken over by the Muslims, and somebody might have to do a crusade to liberate America someday.
No, it may not be as unlikely as most people think. Let's go to Jerry calling from Los Angeles. Hi, Jerry. Question or comment?
Oh, just a bit of information I'd like to pass on to you. You know, I watch Spanish television to keep up, you know, with my Spanish, but I've been noticing the last couple of months how many times I've seen, like, these Middle Eastern-themed shows, and I see people speaking Spanish and dressed like mullahs, and there's this Shakira who has this, you know, she's a popular Colombian singing star, and she's getting some notoriety here too, and she has this whole Middle Eastern seventh veils type of thing, but the whole thing to me looks like it's a way of, because the people who sponsor Shakira and all these Univision, they're the same Coca-Colas, and they're the ones that own it. The big money people, American big money people, are trying to like brainwash, you know, the Hispanic people to be sympathetic to this Muslim invasion that we have.
Okay, fine. Anything else, Jerry?
No.
All right, thanks so much for calling in. I think it's a point well taken. And
okay.
And we do have a Muslim invasion of America, and back before they changed the immigration laws in 1965, and of course, it was during the Vietnam War, they did change America, and one of the things they did, in addition to taking prayer out of schools and legalize abortion and the Great Society and socialism, they changed the immigration laws. Before that, we had 50,000 Muslims and maybe 20 mosques, and today we've got, the figures vary, but the latest figure is about 7 million Muslims, of which about 1.6 million go to mosques that are in this country. About over 1,000 mosques, 80% of them are teaching this radical Islamic religion of Wahhabism. And then, of course, within our within our prison system with 2 million people, one in every six is now a Muslim. They've been converted to the Muslim religion in our prisons with money that's come from Saudi Arabia and the blessing, of course, of the people who control our country. So we're actually creating a fifth column within this nation because the form of Muslim faith that's being taught in our religions is that of Wahhabism and hatred of the infidels.
Yes, and I think one of the things that the politicians do, and some of these people on radio that this young man was talking about, is they say, look, Hispanic people are brown-skinned, and the Muslims are brown-skinned, and let's be against the white people. And that confuses. My wife is from Guatemala, and many people in our church are Hispanic. And I think that we need to see this not as a skin color thing, but as whether it's true or not, whether it's demonic or not, whether it's helpful to people or not, whether it causes pain and suffering. If you get your pencil ready, I'm going to give you my website. You might want to take a look at that.
Okay.
In just a minute. The listeners may want to look at our website. There's so much more material that we've got up there that I think they would find it very interesting.
Go right ahead.
It's www.rlhymersjr. You got to put the JR on the end. My dad was senior, and I'm junior. rlhymersjr.com. I'll give that again a little bit later, and you'll find we have all kinds of stuff on demons and I put a little comment on the news every week on there as well, and then my sermons are all there. They take them down word for word and put them up beautifully formatted on the website. It's www.rlhymersjr.com, and I'll say it again in a few minutes.
All right, that's the Dr. R.L. Hymers Jr. .com, but of course you have to be a little more specific when you get into the websites. But of course, you spend the first half of the book simply talking about the fact that there are demons, there are fallen angels here, and going into the biblical background, and simply quoting extensively from the Bible about the fact that they were there when Christ walked the earth. They were there in the Old Testament. They were there after Christ's resurrection, and of course, Paul and the others that came in contact with these demonic spirits.
Yes.
And of course, the idea that, most people don't believe in that. They believe in ghosts, maybe, or poltergeists. But of course, what are ghosts and poltergeists?
Well, yeah. See, what we've done, Doc, is we've gone in the first part of the book. I go through and I show what the Bible says about where demons came from, and I think that's a very fascinating subject. I just briefly say that the Bible teaches that Satan was cast out of heaven, and that part of the angels listened to him, and they were also cast out. Now, my conviction is, and we give all the scriptures for these things, but my conviction is that part of these demons in the days of Noah possessed people, and there was some sort of sexual intercourse, actually, taking place through the demonic, and that's not real clear how that works, but we give the basic view of that. And those demons that possess people in that way then were cast into hell, but the rest of them were left on earth. Now, these are the demons that Jesus encountered, and he spent a great deal of time. If you just read the four Gospels, just raw, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, just read them, and it's fascinating how many times the demons are spoken of again and again and again and again. We give a whole bunch of those instances there. And then, of course, in the book of Acts, the Apostle Paul, for instance, in the first half of Acts.
We're going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be right back in 3 minutes here for the last half hour of our Radio Liberty program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs for your help in getting out the truth across America. So if you believe that we are involved in a spiritual battle being fought on the political and ideological battlefield, if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, we hope that many of you, of course, will give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. I do want to mention that we're going to be having an all-day seminar on the 23rd of November of next month. That's the weekend before Thanksgiving. And we really think it's very important we get people together. We talk about what is going to be happening in this next year and, of course, what you must do to begin to prepare yourself for what I believe are going to be very, very difficult times. Because if I'm right that we are moving into a new world war, that the Third World War is not too far off, that what we're doing now and going into the Middle East will eventually inflame Muslims throughout the world and lead to unrest here in the United States. And we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to coming to that. And, of course, there's going to be a luncheon and going to be a seminar for everybody. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's an all-day seminar. Doors open at 8 in the morning, close at 5 o'clock in the evening. Actually, we go till 6 o'clock, but we'll stop giving the programs at 5, and we're going to have Joan Paris, who's a frequent visitor, a guest on our program, Jeannie Soderman, Bill Sardi. I think you'll be fascinated. His remarks on health and immunity, and I'll be talking on vaccination. Brad Dacus will be there. But give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and hopefully you can come and you can get other people to come. Bring as many as you can. We need to get started to know how many we're going to be having. So give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR if you can make it to our all-day seminar, which will be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course on the 23rd of November. So, again, if you would like to join the Radio Liberty family, our number, the same, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Remember our website. It's radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our newsletters. You can pull down our programs. You can listen to us 5 hours a day on the Internet and not get anything accomplished, but we actually have some people who actually listen 5 hours a day, and bless them for doing that. And I just hope that we can always give you information, new information that will help you better be able to reach others with the truth about what's going on today. So, of course, we'll be back then in just a moment with our special guest for this evening, Dr. R. L. Heimers, Jr., and his book, Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. R.L. Heimers, Jr., and if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment. Our telephone number, 464-8295, here in the Central Coast of California. Out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, you know, one of the things is I don't think most people really understand the Islamic religion. It is so different than Christianity, so demanding and so really violent in its very nature. Would you like to sort of talk about the last half of the book and what the message that people in America have to understand about Islam? We're told by our president that Islam means peace. Does Islam mean peace?
No, it does. It absolutely does not. Let me wrap up what I was saying there. In regard to the demons, and then we'll come. Let me come over to that. the book of Acts, then we have Paul dealing with the demonic and the Lord Jesus in the four Gospels. Throughout history, since the first century, over 600 religions have come out. There are more than 600 religions in the world. And each one of these religions is a means by which the demonic attacks the truth of God's word. Now, in the Islamic religion, you have this man, Muhammad, who was originally a pagan, but he has a series of revelations in which he says he himself felt that he was under demonic influence. A passage from the Hadith, Volume 1, Book 1, he says himself, I'm under demonic influence. It was only after a considerable length of time that his wife was able to convince him that it was a divine influence. Well, of course, I'm convinced that it was a demonic influence that led him into this religion. And it is basically extreme monotheism. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, monotheism, but it's an extreme. The central idea of Islam is the unity of God. And that is that God is a unit. Now, the Bible reveals that God is indeed a unit, but he's also a Trinity. And by the Trinity, we don't mean that it's three gods. That's a misrepresentation by Islam. Christians do not believe in three gods. Christians believe in one God who exists in three persons. Now, that's a mystery. And some people are not happy with mysteries, but the word mysterion, translated mystery, is in the First Corinthians chapter 15. It's a biblical word. Behold, I show you a mystery, a mysterion. So there are some things that our minds don't completely comprehend. God said, my ways are higher than your ways. There are things about God that we don't completely understand with the human mind. But the scripture reveals that God is a Trinity. For instance, we read there's one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. So it's obvious when Jesus died on the cross, he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Obviously, there is some difference between the persons in the Trinity as we read the New Testament. The Muslims don't believe that. They believe just... Now, somebody says, well, do they believe in God the Father? No, they do not. As John of Damascus pointed out, and we quote all of this. This is all brought out in great detail in the book. The book is Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. Dr. Stan is offering the book here, and he'll tell you about it in a few minutes. It's by myself, R.L. Hamers, Jr., and John S. Waldrop. And what we show in this book is that God is not, Allah is not God. And the reason is, John of Damascus brought this out in the 6th century, late 6th century, is that the God of the New Testament is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. That's why he's called God the Father, because he's God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Allah is not the Father of anybody, and certainly not Jesus Christ. So that's the basic difference between the Allah of Islam and the God of Christianity. The Allah of Islam is not anybody's father, but God, in the New Testament, we call him, instinctively, we call him God the Father. Why? Because he's God the Father of Jesus Christ, and he's the father of all those who by adoption become children of God. Also, the New Testament teaches the Trinity of God, that God exists in three persons. This is very important, and it's very basic to the difference between Islam and Christianity. And I know the president and other well-meaning people say, well, we all believe in the same God, and I'm not sure President Bush has said that, but many of the leaders say we all believe in the same God, and can't we all get along, and that sort of thing. And yes, we should all try to get along, and we should be very nice to the Muslim people, and we point that out in the book. I have a friend, an acquaintance, a quite a good acquaintance who's a practicing Muslim. And I go to see him. I'm going to take him this book, and I'm going to give him a copy of it. We just gotten the book the last few weeks. But he's a very nice man. Every Muslim that I have known is a very nice, sweet person in this country. And I think maybe one of the reasons is that most of them that come here, you know, intuitively, instinctively realize this is a better place to live than most Muslim countries. The terrorists come here, of course, for other reasons. I'm not saying that every Muslim is a wild, demon-possessed person, but I am saying that they are all of them deluded and tricked by the Quran, which is a product of the demonic influence, satanic influence on the mind of Muhammad, and produced this book, which takes monotheism to its end extreme, and therefore violates the New Testament, because in the New Testament, God the Father, and it's always speaks of God the Father, God the Father. Why? He's the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and he's the Father of Christians. But Muhammad's God, Allah, is not anybody's father. That's the basic difference.
Well, I thought that, of course, that Allah was the moon god. That's why they have the moon on their flags.
Well, absolutely.
Of course, this is really a pagan god.
Yes.
This is not certainly the god of the Old Testament and the New Testament, the god of the heavens, but is simply one of many, many pagan gods. But of course, you go to India, they have a whole flock of pagan gods. The Mohammedans have just one pagan god, but he is still a pagan god, and they simply selected one of their multiple gods, and they called him Allah.
Yes. Well, that's no. And the word Allah existed before Muhammad. As you said, Allah was one of many pagan gods, and what Muhammad did is he selected that one. He said, "This, the moon god, this is the one, and he's the only god." And that's basically it. Yes.
All right, fine. So, I mean, I think that people have to understand it is a different God. And this is a God that really is a very, very vengeful God. I mean, certainly they believe in paradise and they believe in hell. But, of course, you can never be certain that you're going to go to paradise unless, of course, you know, no matter how good you are and you keep all the rules and pray five times a day and give to the poor and go to Mecca and all of these things and obey the Islamic law. But the only way you really know you're going to go to heaven is to die killing infidels. And it's beautifully exemplified on a CBS program, I think on the 1st of September, where, of course, Maury Safer was interviewing these four Islamic girls, and you've probably heard me tell the story. The four girls raised in America, born in America, gone to an Islamic high school, and they all agreed that it would be so wonderful, to die for Allah, because then you go immediately to paradise. And one of the girls looked almost happy as she said, if I were to go to a naval base and blow myself up, why, of course, I would go immediately to paradise. And then I think several weeks later, somebody said, "Do you realize what you've said to the American people?" And she called CBS and she said, "Well, I was talking about going to an Israeli naval base and blowing myself up." So, and of course, I always ask the question, how many naval bases do they have in Israel?
Right. The thing is, you see, Islam doesn't deal with sins being forgiven, and there's no concept of sin being forgiven. And so, what you have to do is you have to merit by your works what you're going to get in paradise, and of course it's a great merit, they think, for you to kill an infidel. And that's right, of course, that's right in the Quran. People often don't realize that Muhammad himself, among his last utterances, here's one of the last things he said: "The Lord destroy the Jews and Christians. Let his anger be kindled against those. Let there not remain any but the faith of Islam," unquote. That's a direct quote. That's quoted by Dr. Philip Schaff in his book, A History of the Christian Church, Volume 4. And we give a whole bunch of quotations in the book directly from the Quran, and they're blood-curdling. That's the only way I can describe it. Believe me, when you read this book, you're going to see, unmasked, just exactly what Islam is. Muhammad for instance, taught sexual indulgence. A Muslim can have, they don't, of course not in this country, but a Muslim is allowed four wives, and of course Muhammad made an exception for himself, and he had 14 wives and concubines beside. The last wife that he married was a 9-year-old child. He was 53 years old, and she was a 9-year-old child. And Jerry Falwell said that Muhammad was a demon-possessed pedophile. Well, of course, Jerry Vines said that, Dr. Jerry Vines, former president of the Southern Baptist Convention. There was a big firestorm over that in the media. But, you know, Doc, if a 53-year-old man in California got a 9-year-old girl and married her, wouldn't we call a man like that a pedophile today? See, so I don't think he was too far off in saying that. There's something basically wrong, as Dr. Philip Schaff points out. To compare such a man with Jesus is preposterous and even blasphemous. Jesus was the sinless Savior of sinners.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that if you know, you say anything good about Christianity,
right,
you'll be attacked. If you say anything bad about the Muslim religion, you'll be attacked.
Oh, yes, because, absolutely.
Because what people don't understand is that there is a spirit of Antichrist, an anti-Christian, a spirit within the media in America,
yes,
today, and with the major opinion molders. And until you understand, you know, that they so often will take, you know, the Christian characters in television programs and make them end up looking just terribly depraved and hypocritical. And this is done for the psychological impact on the watchers, to equate Christianity with hypocrisy.
Absolutely.
But if you were to dare do something like that, as far as the Muslims were concerned, why, you know, there would be a firestorm. You're not to criticize any other religion, only Christianity, because I think there are two religions in the world. There's Christianity, and then there are all the others.
That's what that's a very interesting observation. I was just reading the other night what the apologist G.K. Chesterton said. That he said the only, any stick was good enough to beat the Christians with. You could beat the any stick at all, and then he shows this way and that way, but no other religion can you do that with. And his point was, and I think he was exactly right, is that that shows that Christianity is the only true religion. In John chapter 3, it says, men hate the light. They will not come to the light because their deeds are evil. And the light of Christianity, that's the one that everybody's against. That's the one that they will not allow in the schools. You know, they're actually teaching Islam in a school up in Northern California. They just put a block on it. And in North Carolina, they just somebody brought a lawsuit. They were actually promoting Islam, and they won't even let the kids say God bless America. Well, it sounds paradoxical, it sounds ridiculous, but as you pointed out, there are really only two religions. There's the Christian religion, and then there are the false religions of man, and Islam is one of them. I wish I could just give you all of this stuff. You get the book. Dr. Stan will give you the way to get it. The book is Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. I have all kinds of other material on my website, and I've given that once. Let me give it to you.
Go ahead and give it again a couple of times.
I only gave it once.
Well, you go ahead and give it a couple of times more.
All right, I'm going to give it one more time. It's www.rlhymersjr.com. rlhymersjr.com. And we have a comment on the news every week, and then they put up my sermons, and I try to put something in them each week that you can't get anyplace else. And I think we pretty well accomplished that. And you take a look and see if you enjoy that or not. I know you're going to like the book, Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. The co-author of the book is Dr. John S. Waldrop, pastor of a church in Monrovia, California. And John has a Ph.D. from Doctor of Theology from Louisiana Baptist Theological Seminary. He spent quite a time working over the doctrines of Islam. And he's really the expert on that. Maybe you could have him. I'm more of the expert on demonology and the Bible, but John is quite an expert on Islam. You may want to have him on at a later time to talk about that. I did go over his part of the book, and I worked over the English, and he gave it to me, and then I reread it and reworked the English. His chapters are, this is toward the end of the book, Is Christianity Insufficient, Uninspired, Inadequate, and Impotent? And you see, if you accept Islam, you actually are saying those things about Christianity. Because Christianity was around for 600 years before Islam. You're saying Christianity really wasn't adequate, so we had to have Islam. And then John, in chapter 8, talks about the growth of Islam. How did it grow? And then he compares the way Islam grew with the way Christianity grew. Christianity grew by preaching, by men preaching the gospel, whereas Islam grew by jihad, by the sword, and by killing. And then he contrasts, has a whole chapter contrasting God and Allah, which I think is very, very interesting. And then he has a whole chapter on Islam's bizarre beliefs about women. Women are thought of as worse than a dog. Why women would want to, I don't know why any woman would want to convert to, but yet many American women are becoming Muslims. And it's very strange.
Well, we live in a world gone, of course. Sometimes I think we live in a world gone mad. You made the point in your book that Spurgeon, the great English minister, was really sort of excommunicated from his faith. Why was that?
Well, Spurgeon was actually censured by the Baptist Union of England, and
but what was the basis for that?
Well, the basis for it was that he was standing for the fundamentals of Christianity, and the Baptist Union in London was getting soft on these things, and so they, very strangely, because Spurgeon was a pastor of the largest church in the world at that time, 5,000, which was a big, big church, 5,000-member Metropolitan Baptist Tabernacle in London, and he was very influential. He had started over 160 churches throughout London and the outlying areas and wrote all these books and everything, but as he's getting older now, they wanted to soften some of the points, particularly some of the strong doctrines on the depravity of man and the need for conversion and so forth. And when he stood and spoke on these things, they more and more wanted a softer gospel. That's the best way to put it. They wanted a softer gospel. And so when they voted to censure him, it was like a wave. One man said there were 17 that voted in favor of not censuring him, and then all these hundreds of others voted to censure him. And it was like a wave, and it was shocking to those that saw it, how this man who one day had been so popular and the next day was censured, and his wife said that killed him.
Well, Chris, I think the thing is that there has been a conscious effort to change the message of the church. And
you're exactly right.
After, of course, Spurgeon, then, of course, Machen. And, of course, Machen was a great minister, and we in our church, we've been reading actually a book he wrote about liberalism and Christianity.
Yes.
And, of course, then he was in turn censured because the people who had taken control of the reins of organized religion didn't like the traditional message of the Bible.
Yes.
They wanted to make it something that would sort of be embraced by everybody.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. And what happened with Spurgeon in the late 19th century, then happened to Gresham Machen in the 1920s. Of course, it happened to poor William Jennings Bryan. He is vilified to this day, and he was a brilliant man. It's because the world in the last few years has rejected the message of the Bible, and we are living in the end times. And this is part of the demonic onslaught of the last days. I just read an article about J. Frank Norris that a man wrote, and he just tears Norris to pieces. Well, I wrote to the editor of the, and he was a great Baptist of independent Baptist of the early 20th century. And I wrote to the editor, and I said, let me write an article defending Norris. And he wrote back, he said, oh, no, you can't do that. Norris had a dark side. Well, He didn't have a dark side. He was standing against liquor. He was standing against prostitution. He was standing against liberalism. And somebody burned his church down, and somebody tried to kill him. Well, of course, those things are going to happen when a man is standing up for the truth. I wish we had some men like Frank Norris today and J. Gresham Machen and Spurgeon. Unfortunately, we live in a day when most of the preachers are pretty quiet, pretty afraid. It's too bad. These are the last days. The Lord Jesus Christ is coming soon, and we have tried to give the real, true message in the book, Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center, and I hope that you'll get a copy of it and read it.
All right, fine. And for our listeners out there, the book, Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center, and if you'd like more information, or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And the reason I wanted to have Dr. Heimers on with us this evening is I think it's an important book. It brings out what we often talk about here, and that is the demonic and the satanic forces at work in the world. Tie those in to the Islamic forces that we are aligned against militarily, we soon will be aligned with against militarily, and then understand that we have within our own country at least 7 million people, many of them, not all of them, but certainly those within the prisons believe that when the chaos comes to our streets, that the prison doors will be opened and they'll be free. These are the rapists and the murderers who are in there who've been converted to Islam in our prisons, and of course so many of the mosques today, over 80% of them are of the radical kind, not preaching the more moderate form of Muslim religion, where all men can live together peacefully, but kill the infidels. Well, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope maybe we can either get you onto some of our other programs or get Dr. Waltrip at some of the other programs as well.
Yes, I have several other books, too. A Puritan Speaks to Our Dying Nation, A Church That Will Be Left Behind, Today's Apostasy, Preaching to a Dying Nation. Maybe I could come on and talk some about some of those other programs. They're all of them are advertised on our website at www.rlhymersjr.com.
All right, God bless you, and thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this evening. A little heavy, but really, this is there are heavy subjects out there, and one thing, we're not going to duck anything that I think needs to be covered, so I recommend Demons in the Smoke of the World Trade Center. And, of course, if you want to understand demonology, if you want to understand the interlock with the Muslim religion, this, of course, is where you're going to get the information. And Dr. Heimers is a very, very courageous individual. He's willing to stand up and say, these are the last days, and you better repent today. Because, of course, we're all going to die. The only question is, where are we going to spend eternity? And so, until Monday at the same time, Dr. Stand, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray we stay out of this terrible war. And please pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection.
Basically, there's two halves of the co-op. I know, but the thing is, with the next